more than anything, Mark, it was mindset, simply belief. I've consistently been maybe around 450, 500 or so in billings. My billings immediately went to like 650 and it just sort of stayed, just literally from belief.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and my very special guest today is John Schlegel. John is the CEO and founder of Stonebridge Search in Austin, Texas, where he places professionals in the financial advisory services arena for global and boutique consulting firms, PE firms, investment banks, and accountancy firms. He also provides support for mergers and acquisitions on both the buy side and the sell side. Welcome, John. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
I'm really looking forward to this. You referred to me by Joe Rice, who I believe you know because you're both members of the Pinnacle Society. Tell me about how you got to know Joe, or why do you think he recommended you specifically?
Yeah, so Joe and I, Joe is one of my very best friends, and he and I came into the Pinnacle Society at the exact same time. So we were in the same conference together, where we were introduced to the Pinnacle Society. So we were really, he didn't refer me into that group, but I guess he did, you know, obviously refer me to you. But Pinnacle, it's interesting, in Pinnacle, I was referred into that group because I had a friend here locally that I was actually trying to rent a space from, who knew the founder of Pinnacle. And she said, look, based on what you do, you should really meet this guy. He happened, ironically, to live in Austin. It's a guy named Mike Goldman. And so I went to have lunch with him, and he said, look, I think you're perfect for our group. And so he introduced me, and I went to a conference with Joe, and we became members together. It's in 2012, I think that was.
Awesome. All right. Well, that's so cool. So one thing I'd love to talk about you is about balancing business success and the other things which are most important to us in life, because I think that's something that is important to you, right? So I guess as an overall theme for today, my question would be, how can a solo practitioner bill $700,000 plus and still have a life? Could you give a little intro to your thoughts on that that question?
Yeah, that's been that's taken a while to come up with the right mix for that. You know, I used to work in a larger company. I mean, not, never worked in a really large company, but certainly a larger company where I had some leverage. And it's much easier to think about how to drive more revenue when you're in that structure. But since 2009, I've been completely on my own. And I wanted to, what kind of gave me the backdrop for how am I going to do this? It was mainly about, how do I serve my clients better? You know, how am I able to tell them I can still do everything you want me to do, but it's just me sitting here now, you know? So how do I do that? And I've just had to get creative over the years about how to create that leverage. And one of the ways that I've done that is I decided that, well, let me back up. One of the things I don't think I'm particularly great at, or maybe it's just that's a cop-out and I just don't like it, is managing people from early stages in their career, training them, building them up through the process. That is not my thing. And that's a challenge, you know, when you're trying to grow your revenue and it's just you. So what I decided to do was take on a couple of contract relationships with in one case, it's a late stage industry executive, very good. He actually ran a recruiting firm at one point, and was in, you know, industry executive positions prior to that. But he's, you know, got a few years left in his career, really knows the business, very polished. And he was just looking for a way to keep his foot in the water in terms of being in our business, but really didn't want to be in charge of anything anymore. So that was perfect for me, because some of the senior level searches that I get, if I don't have enough time for them, I'm able to leverage those to him. So that was one thing that gave me a way to do it. And then I've also picked up relationships with just sort of contract recruiters that are in my area that specialize in my kind of general scope of what I recruit for. And that's been very helpful as well. But it all kind of started with this concept of, you know, how do I get broader with my client while being small? Because I think it's critical. I mean, just the most critical thing I would say about my business is you have to transition to a position of trusted advisor and not just vendor. And that's, you know, I think it all starts from that position. And so, you know, one of the things I think hopefully separates me from competitors in my space is that they, you know, we tend to in this business, I think the worst of us in this business, in my opinion, are the ones that come with just this approach of, you know, I've got this candidate. Are you interested? Oh, you're not. Do you know anyone who might be interested in this candidate? Or if you work it on the other side of the desk, it's, do you have any openings? Well, great. Let me know when you have any openings. And it comes off as sort of a very, very transactional view of what we do. Mm-hmm. And so what I've tried to do is think more broadly about and exhaustively also about what my clients are trying to accomplish. You know, what step back from it and say, look, what are you, I understand you need this particular professional, but what is it that this year you're looking to do? Why do you want that professional? How are you trying to grow? And then I've tried to position myself as, okay, look, even though I have a particular skill set personally, how can I connect with people that can help me better serve my client more broadly? So as an example, one of the things that my clients are looking to do in many cases is make acquisitions. And so they're growing by acquiring other firms. Mm-hmm. Sometimes what I was starting to notice was some of the higher level placements that I was making with my clients were almost supplements to what their greater goals were. So I thought, you know what? I've got to find a way to be able to help them with acquisitions. I didn't set out to be an acquisitions guy, but I thought this is what my client needs. And if I want to be more of an advisor, I have to be able to help them in this way. So for me, what that looked like was creating relationships with private equity firms and investment banks that serve my space. And in, like, for example, in one instance, I have a relationship with an investment bank that acquires firms like my clients. Mm-hmm. And so I have worked out a structure with them where I refer deals to them that make sense. And that is a big benefit to my clients, particularly the boutique level clients that are looking to eventually be acquired. Sometimes it's firms that my clients are looking to acquire. I will have access to those as well. And if it's something that's not something I actually do myself, I have that third party relationship to help me with that. So it's done kind of two things in that particular example. One is it's created a new revenue stream for me that's a little bit passive, honestly. I mean, it's something that once I sort of light the fuse on it, I don't have to do a whole lot more. But it's that relationship building with my client that allows them to do what they're, you know, a little bit more than what their greater goals are. So that's, I've tried to think about my practice in that way. And then, of course, I'm still going to get the searches that I want to work on. And frankly, I get better searches as a result of this mentality of really thinking about how to serve my client. But I just feel like having a more broad, holistic view of the way that I can help my clients has really served me.
It's so smart, John. I think your whole strategic approach to this makes total sense. But how did you come to this? Like, how did you, because you didn't come from a PE or a investment banking background, did you?
No.
So how did this evolve so to the point it is now where you've got these relationships and you can be that strategic advisor to your client firms and actually help them to achieve their bigger, you know, ambitions rather than just you're filling open slots?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. You know, I think it started from a place of just being intellectually curious all the time mm-hmm. and asking tons of questions of the senior people at my clients. You know, what are you, again, it started with what are you trying to do? And then it was, well, okay, we're looking to make acquisitions. Great. Well, who are the target companies? who are the firms on the M&A side that do support for M&A that are big in your space? You know, can I get an introduction to those people? So just by asking a lot of questions about who those people are and then reaching out. And I found over the years that they're often amazed. You know, I think sometimes as recruiters, especially if we're very niche-y like I am, we take for granted the volume of just information we have about our little world that we live in. And when you really step back and think about it, you may, in your niche, you may know more than literally anyone on the planet. And so when you call these people and you say, look, say it's a private equity firm, and you start getting very specific about this niche, and it's, they're like, well, that's crazy. That's my world. Like, but the problem is I don't know all, I don't have those institutional relationships that you do at our target companies. So they're thrilled that you give them a call because it's something that they don't have. You know, it's, hey, we know how to put deals together. We know what we want, but we don't know these people intimately. So we, a lot of times they're chasing leads that initially are very, they don't know a lot of people at those places. They just know they on paper make a lot of sense. So I'm able to help them, you know, get a warm introduction and things of that nature. So it's just making calls, you know, it's asking people, you know, smart questions about who are the folks that really move the needle in that space. And then making those calls, you know, it's actually an extension of what we already do as recruiters.
It's fascinating, John, because I think a lot of us, and I'd probably include myself in this, just have blinkers on. So you just focus like, this is what I do. This is what I know about. And you're really taking those off and saying, well, actually, as a recruiter, I have so much information and knowledge about this world, this niche that I specialize in. How else could I apply that to the benefit of my clients, my candidates, and obviously to my firm as well? And it's just it's a fantastic way of thinking. You mentioned intellectual curiosity, asking lots of questions, and then building relationships with the right people. Do you set up deals that benefit you financially outside of the placement fees then? And so that you have multiple streams of income?
Yes. So for example, with an investment bank, I would, you know, it varies depending on how much involvement I'm going to have. But with an investment bank, I would have a deal where I would share, you know, a reasonable percentage of the fees that they would do on the back once a transaction actually happens, you know, they collect the money. Sometimes with private equity firms, for example, I will have two types of relationships with them. One would be if they're actively looking for firms that are in my niche, where I will, it's like a buy, that's more of a buy side relationship. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have that with, say, like accounting firms. They may say, hey, in general, this is a target area that we're looking to grow in. If you find a particular firm that fits this area, obviously it's a much, you know, you're not going to get 30% of that, but you're going to get, still a pretty good piece of that when it comes down to it. Certainly much bigger than a normal fee for a candidate. And then with the other thing I'll do with private equity firms is, again, thinking more broadly about what it is that my whole ecosystem that I work in is, who are the firms that could serve, for example, their portfolio firms that are in my niche? Doesn't make sense if they're not people I don't already know. So, but if they're like, you know what, it's funny, we have this client, we have this portfolio firm that's really struggling in a certain area. You know, maybe it's their CFO. They're having trouble getting their systems up to speed or whatever. I may have a firm in my space I happen to that's all they do is they come in and advise on, listen, we can fix that. So in that instance, I might have a relationship with the firm that's actually providing that service. So for example, it might be say 10% of what it is that they're going to get. So it's thinking about, how can I make introductions to people that really need each other and create a percentage that I carve off of that for the introduction that is reasonable? I mean, they still have to make, you know, the majority of the money, obviously, in that. But I think the way I think about that is it's somewhat passive. You know, it's not, I don't, with a search, it is very hands-on. I mean, from start right. to finish, you are absolutely exhaustively, I mean, you could take 80, 90, 100 hours on that search of my personal time. So yeah. therefore I deserve, you know, the full freight on that. But if it's one of these other things, I just sort of light the fuse and walk away, and you get enough of them that actually happened. I was actually shocked. When I first did this, I had a friend of mine who recommended I try this. And I was like, you know, I just don't, this just seems so out there. Like, that's not what I do. How's that going to work? And it did. And it worked. And it was like, it's worked 5 or 6 times now. And it's, you know, you start to pick up more confidence that, you know what, they actually really like this. They're starting to see me differently now because I think about these sorts of things for them. Mm-hmm. And then you start thinking the next layer, like, wait a minute, who are the other firms that I know that might appreciate these relationships that I have? And, you know, I think then it puts a lot of responsibility on you though, Mark, because you have to be careful not to abuse that relationship, you know, and start mm-hmm. to turn them on to things that don't make sense. It has to really be something that's coming from a place of helping them. But I think as long as you keep that mindset, there are so many things we can do that we just don't think we can do, or we don't realize we can do, you know?
Amazing, John. What I love about this is that it also, you use the word trusted advisor, which I like, and the term I use is respected leader in your field. Mm-hmm. I think too many recruiters, especially like if you're running a solo practice, we don't necessarily think of ourselves as leaders, right? You're not managing a team necessarily, but at the same time, I believe that you can occupy that status within your ecosystem if you can provide significant value and really just step into that leadership role. No one's going to confer that, you know, that leadership upon you, right? You just have to confer it on yourself and decide, I'm going to try and help people in a bigger way. And maybe it doesn't necessarily directly benefit me even, but I want to be occupy a more central role in the world that I serve. And I really think that elevates you above the sort of more transactional recruiters who are out there hustling and grinding and just chasing the placement fees. Of course, we need to make placements, but does that make sense? Is it more of a mindset shift?
Yeah, it is. It's just thinking more broadly about how you can help. And if you're just going to find that if you can take the blinders off just a little bit every day and realize, you know what? And the question I always ask myself is what is the bigger goal of what we're trying to accomplish with this particular client or this search? Yeah. And taking the time to ask them your clients those questions.
Right.
It opens up all sorts of doors that you don't. And at the absolute minimum, you're building more of your brand to those people. You're elevating yourself above your, even if you never did any of these ancillary things I'm talking yes. about. It creates a different relationship with your client in the way that
it's right. It's a different conversation. Even I can imagine that gives you a stronger entry point into the relationship as well. If they perceive you as being not just another recruiter, there's nothing wrong with being a recruiter. I love recruiters and I think it's a noble profession. But there is a lot of recruiters, right? And so if you have a different take on this and you can provide additional value that others can't, I think it's a huge, huge advantage. But actually, something you said about thinking more broadly and asking more questions about the bigger objective is important for every recruiter to do so that you understand why your client is making this hire, right? Because even if it's just something as like a developer or a team of developers, and you're saying, well, Why are you hiring these developers? Well, we've got a new update. We want to release a new product into the marketplace. Okay, awesome. And why do you want to do that? And well, because, we want to increase our market share. We want to, overtake the competitors. We want to generate upgrades to our existing, base of users. Okay, interesting. And then what does that do for you? Oh, well, that means that we can become, instead of right now, we're the number six company in our field, we want to move up and become in the top three. And okay, well, why do you want to do that? Well, because, in 5 years' time, we're going to float on the stock market and we need to be, one of the leading firms in the top 10% of our industry, et cetera, right? And so if you're the recruiter placing a developer in that context, you've got a lot more to work with, both in terms of presenting the opportunity to the candidate, but also leverage with the client. So then if they say, if they start dragging their heels or taking too long over decisions, you could say, look, if we delay on this, how's it going to affect your release of this new product update? And they're like, oh, well, I guess we're going to miss. Okay. And what impact does that have on you increasing your market share? Right. So I think recruiters just need to really understand what the client is trying to achieve in order to be able to serve them at the highest level, and also make sure the client doesn't mess this up, right? Because clients sometimes mess things up because they're not appreciating how what we're trying to do affects the bigger picture as well. Sorry, I went off on a tangent there.
No, that's great. Yeah, absolutely.
A topic I feel passionate about. So let's rewind for a few minutes, John. And you said you started your firm in 2009. Mm-hmm. And why did you decide to set up on your own?
Yeah, I didn't initially have that goal. I had kind of a wild curveball in the 2007 to 2009 area. I had a lot happening, and I was working for a little boutique firm in Nashville, which is where I lived at the time. This was 01 to 07. I lived in Nashville, and my wife at the time got breast cancer and actually died at a very young age, 33, very early 2007. And so I didn't really have any family there. I liked the firm that I was working with, but I just I had my wife's family, but I didn't have a lot of ties to that area. So I knew I maybe needed a change in my life. I didn't know at the time that it was going to involve starting my own firm. But I ended up meeting just a fantastic lady who I'm now married to at a conference that I was at in Texas. Well, she wasn't at the conference, but I met her actually at the airport of all places.
Wow.
And So we ended up hitting it off and, dating long distance for a little over a year. And eventually it led to me moving here to Austin. And when I did, it became pretty apparent early on that my company that I was working with, which I did continue to work with for a while here in Austin, but they just weren't really doing what I do. And it was a great departure, great guys, but I just felt like it was time to make a leap and start my own firm. Now, what I didn't realize was that year was actually going to be the most, at least here in the United States, the most challenging year in my career, and just in general with the markets. 2009.
What year was that, John? Oh, 2009. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, believe me, I understand.
Great timing to start a firm, right? But so that was a wild stretch from 2007 to 2009. But that's kind of how I got started with my.
Oh my gosh, that's wow! So I don't even know where to start with that. It sounds like that whole period was just so much change in such a short period of time. Did you have children as well, or you from your previous wife? Yeah.
Yes, I had two children. They're now at the time they were 4 and 2, and now they're 18 and 16.
Wow. So, okay. Gosh.
And I have two additional kids as well now. So I have 18, 16, 11, and 6. So we're pretty busy.
Wow, that's amazing. So you ended up meeting somebody, moving to Texas, starting a firm, expanding your family. So she had, did she have kids already, or you have had more kids together?
Yeah, she had no kids. We've just had more together.
Got it. Okay. So you brought your two, then you expanded your family, you started your firm. Like, how did you stay sane during that crazy, you know, roller coaster of personal and business events? I mean, that sounds brutal.
Yeah. You know, I was kind of blessed that it's funny how in my life, everything's kind of happened for a particular reason, but in Nashville is a very healthcare focused city. And so the pieces of my service areas that I've recruited in that were related to healthcare, I started to focus on a lot more in when I was in Nashville. And that paid huge dividends in 2009 because it was one of the few industries, at least in my area of focus, that didn't really have a tremendous downturn. So I was able to kind of just survive really on healthcare that year. But it was, it was crazy. I mean, it was, there was a lot of just kind of think about the next thing that's in front of you and just do whatever you can to close this deal. And it really was the only year in my entire recruiting career that it felt like a job. It felt like, wow, this is about just getting to the next day, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, 2008, 2009, my business fell off a cliff. I made the classic mistake of, I had too many eggs and too few baskets. I got like 80% of revenue was from five companies, and four out of the five stopped doing all. And I at the time, my business model was doing training for larger recruiting and staffing firms. And they were growing and hiring like crazy, right, in the run up to sort of 2008. And they had all these people and they're like, Mark, can you come back? We've got another batch for you to train and so on. And then they all not only stopped hiring, but started like contracting. And of course, training is one of the first things that gets axed, right, is from the budget when companies are trying to survive. So like my income dropped in half almost overnight. I remember it was July 2008. And that was pretty scary and had to totally reinvent what I was doing and how I was doing it. So you were parallel in Austin trying to build your search firm. So then once things started recovering, what happened next? How did you evolve the business in the direction that it's, you know, it's taking today?
Yeah, I think the freedom that I had that came from starting my own firm gave me a lot. That was kind of the launch point for my mindset of how can I get broader and deeper, as we discussed earlier with my clients.
Yes.
And, you know, I started taking on more things that were acquisition related, things of that nature. But it was also Pinnacle. I mean, Pinnacle, I have to say, at the end of the day, was by far the most meaningful in terms of just production in my business. Before Pinnacle, I had never really been around any sort of formal training or a group of people that were really, I mean, I had a few individual friendships of people that were pretty productive in the industry, but they were just local level folks that happened to be in the firms that I was in. And I didn't know what I didn't know. You know, I mean, I had no concept of what was good or what was not great in our industry in terms of production. Mm-hmm. So when I went to my first Pinnacle meeting, it was, I was the absolute low man on the totem pole. I mean, I had always been at firms that I'd been at before, either the top guy or at least the number two guy in production. But one of the things we do at Pinnacle is the first day, we sort of go around the table and everybody gives the status of where they're at for the year and what they're projecting at. And I was like halfway around the table. It's like 80 people, you know, so I'm about halfway around the table. And I'm like, oh my God. I mean, there's been 40 people go. I'm the lowest numbers. Like this is insane, you know? And so it was, but what I found was that it wasn't so much once I started talking with those people about how do you do this? I don't understand how there's enough time in the day. I realized it was more than anything, Mark, it was mindset. It was just simply belief that it was, I believe that I deserve to be having these types of conversations. And there were some structural things that I learned too from it, some little tweaks that really helped. But it was mainly just a belief thing, man. I mean, the next year, my best year ever at that point, I think, well, I had 1 year where I did like in the sixes somewhere, but I've consistently been maybe around 450, 500 or so in billings. My billings immediately went to like 650, and it just sort of stayed just literally from belief in being.
Wow. Before I go to my next question, I'd like to share one of the keys to my success in recruitment and in business. You may have noticed that a lot of the people I interview on this show have a coach. That's not a coincidence. Most high achievers have a coach, including me. I've worked with various coaches over the last 20 years, and it's been a huge factor in my own personal and business growth. Here's why. Sometimes it's hard to see the forest for the trees, and it really helps to take a step back and look at how you can improve the business and get a fresh outside perspective from someone who's bringing new ideas and insights to the table. Plus, as a business owner, who is holding you accountable and helping you stay on track? So I want to encourage you, if you're not already working with a coach, get one. It doesn't have to be me. There are plenty of amazing coaches out there. Just find someone who you believe will add measurable value to your business and can help you get to the next level. If you do want to explore a coaching relationship with me, then you're welcome to apply for a free 30-minute strategy session at recruitmentcoach.com/breakthrough. This is not a sales call. My number one objective is to help you to get clear on your goals, identify the roadblocks that are holding you back, and create a strategic plan to increase your billings and grow your business. I promise you'll leave our session feeling focused, re-energized, and excited to take your business to the next level. You can apply at recruitmentcoach.com/breakthrough. John, can you elaborate on what that mindset shift was specifically? Like, what can you give an example of the sorts of, like, what you used to believe and now what you now believe that has allowed you to tap into more of your potential? Because this is the thing, you didn't get smarter all of a sudden. It sounds like you weren't necessarily working any harder, and yet you were able to unlock a whole nother level. So could you elaborate on that mindset shift?
Sure. Yeah, a part of it was that I think I was suffering a little bit from that. I'm a vendor. You know, I don't even know that I consciously was aware of it. I was just sort of doing the job. Look, I got to get X amount of placements. And I was very kind of methodical, and I'm probably typical of most recruiters that are in our business. You know, you just go in, you have X amount of dials you're going to make per day. And I thought of the business in that way. What I didn't realize that mindset, at least for me, can do is it can make you believe that you don't deserve a certain level of seat at the table with your clients in terms of the mind share of what, you know, what is those conversations of what are the greater issues in your space. Mm-hmm. I think subconsciously I sort of felt like before Pinnacle, that was all, I didn't sort of deserve to be in those conversations, if that makes sense. One of the things that I learned that's more of a practical answer is what Jordan Rayboy, who's also been on your podcast, great friend of mine. He was actually just here a couple weeks ago.
Oh, cool.
I think he shared this on the episode he was on with you, where he talked about the, hey, if you need to make X amount per year and you extrapolate those hours out that you're going to work, that's say $300 an hour. What are the activities that are $300 an hour or less that you are spending your time on every day? And that's something I immediately learned from Pinnacle. That was one of the very first conversations I had at my very first Pinnacle meeting. And I thought, you know what? He's right. I'm spending probably 60% of my time on things that are less meaningful than I should be. And so that's when I started thinking about, wait a minute, I've got to, even if I don't want to have a big company, I've got to create relationships with people who those things are their lane. You know, that's what they want to do. So I hired a full-time assistant. I had not had one up to that point. And then I started creating these contract relationships with other people. you know, being willing to hire companies that do certain things that I was spending tons of time on that were just not productive. So that's an example of what I, you know, how it made some changes.
Yeah. So I guess part of it was feeling worthy of a seat at the, you know, at the table with the top decision makers in your client companies, and feeling that I deserve to be here. I'm bringing value, and ultimately I can benefit these companies and help them achieve their goals. The other was understanding the value of your time and identifying opportunities that you could delegate or outsource tasks that didn't require your personal, you know, time in order to get them accomplished. So that's huge. What was the, so you mentioned these contract recruiters. Are these freelancers essentially, or are they research firms? Like, what's the dynamic there?
Sure. I've tried a little bit of everything. I've tried outsourced kind of, you know, I've tried India, you know, things that where you're looking, especially at lower levels. I've tried that, lower levels of searches. Mm-hmm. I've had kind of mixed success with that. I think there are certain types of searches that they're particularly good at. At least the ones that I've used. I think where I've had the most, I know where I've had the most success is with local experienced contract recruiters. So I'm working with them on a, what we here in the States call 1099 basis.
Yeah.
And so they are their own boss, but I give them searches that I have. And then sometimes we'll share searches. If it's something that, for example, the most senior individual I work with has a space here in my building. And he has his own firm and he does his own searches, but he and I will share searches, sometimes searches that he found and sometimes searches that I found. But I love working with the common thread with everyone I work with is they're very seasoned, because right. I need to not have downtime. I need to know, hey, I can spend an hour with this person explaining to them exactly what the little nuances and buzzwords are. And then they get the recruiting piece of it. I don't have right. to teach them that. Yeah. So that's been my focus. So to answer your question, they are sort of contract independent people.
Got it. So 1099 means they're self-employed. Do you pay by the hour, by the project, or like a success fee? Like how does that work?
It, you know, if it's a search that I give to someone, for me personally, what I found most successful is I just split it. I mean, if I'm going to give them the search, in order to attract this level of person on a 1099 basis, I think you have to give them 50% of the fee in my space. Okay. Now, that might not be true everywhere, but in my space, that's what I do.
Got it. So typically, I know there's been instances where you share searches someone else might have brought to the table, but you're the kind of face of the business and you're the lead, you know, client relationship manager, business developer. You bring a search on, and then do you ever do the delivery part yourself, or do you always like choose one of your contract recruiters who's you think is going to be the most appropriate person for that?
Well, I mean, on most of my searches, I'm doing all of it.
Oh, I see.
Is that what you meant? Like, do I?
Yeah,
do
I thought maybe you had like a system where you would win the search and then you would hand off to your delivery team, whoever you know was going to be involved in that project, and then you would oversee the process. But then you're on to winning the next one.
Yeah. No. So in my space, I have what I typically do is I will have maybe 4 to 5 searches that I'm working at any given time.
Yep.
That are the ones that I believe are the best use of my personal time. On those searches, I'll be running those things from start to finish personally.
Got it.
I do, though, get all these other searches that come in that are I really need to be able to serve my client on those. So those are the ones that I'll pull in some help for.
I see.
Yeah.
So how do you decide what you're personally going to work on and what you're going to mm-hmm. Hand off?
Sometimes a decent amount of the time, it's about the level of the search, the complexity okay. of the search. If it's a higher level search, I will generally handle those most of the time. If it's a mid-level search, unless it's very specific and I know I'm the only person that's got that institutional knowledge to know how to find it, if it's something that's relatively easy to find, I will then use one of these individuals for that. And that, I have to tell you, Mark, that was initially very challenging for me. And I get the sense that that's probably challenging for a lot of recruiters, is that we can get this mindset of nobody can do this like I can do it.
Right. Exactly.
And the reality is, if they can do it 80% as well as you do, and you give them a couple of chances to do it, now maybe they're 90% as good as you. Yeah. And if it's a search that to begin with is kind of moderately difficult, you need to give somebody else that search. I mean, that's been my experience. And this is only if you're going to stay small like me. Now, of course, if you're going to build a 25-person firm, the equation changes completely. Yep. But if you want to be a solo person and be able to serve your clients as though you're not, you have to get creative like this. And be willing to let go of some things. I mean, that has been a really, it still to this day is hard for me that I have to look at certain searches and go, you know what? It's in my client's best interest that I get some help with this. Because if I don't, I'm not going to be able to put as much of myself into the searches that they need more of my personal attention on.
Right.
And it just so happens that I end up making more money as a result of that. I think if I started from a notion of how can I make the most money, I don't think it would work as well. I have to think about what's going to serve the client the best and then back into it.
All right, got it. So the first question is what is going to serve the client? Is it going to be me working the search, or is it going to be involving someone else? Along with this concern of giving up control or giving it to someone who might not be as good or what have you. Surely there is a danger of picking the wrong person. Like how do you test people or find new people who maybe you haven't worked with before? I'm sure now you've got your trusted folks, but in the beginning when you were creating this model, because there's a risk that they don't deliver, right? And then you've made a promise to the client and then you're not delivering on that promise. So how did you overcome that issue?
I certainly did was you have to be willing to take the search back. If it's starting to fail, I still have oversight of the search. Yeah. So I'm seeing the candidates come in. I know if they're good or not. And if I'm consistently sensing that my contract recruiter is just not getting it in this particular subject matter area, I will either call the client and say, listen, I don't think we can fill this, or I will take over on the search. I've had to do both. You know, sometimes I've realized along the way that, you know what, it's not the contract recruiter that's the issue. This is a rough search. I'm not sure we can fill this. So I think you have to be willing to do a little trial and error with these people that you're using and understand that you may have to take these searches back. And I'm very transparent with the recruiters I work with too, that listen, I have to serve the client first. And so if this is not working, I may in fact take this thing back. And, you know, I think as long as you're transparent with them, they're okay with that.
Makes total sense. And are they working with you more or less full time, or do they have other clients that they're also working with? How do you negotiate that?
You know, so far it's worked out where they're working with other stuff, their own things as well. They may be working even with other recruiters like me. One thing I do think you have to be very, very careful with when you're doing this is making sure that they're not potentially serving three or four people that do the same thing. So what I do is so specific that it's highly, highly unlikely that they would be also supporting someone that has the same types of searches.
Yeah.
But I think some people in the industry, if you're, let's say you're generally recruiting accounting and finance, that if you're in a, say, middle market city like I am, you can have situations that are difficult there where you're actually directly competing, you know, creating a problem. I'm very careful about that to make sure that they know enough about my space that they can probably do it, but they're not in my space, if that makes sense. I understand going in, I'm gonna have to train a little bit of my space to them.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Interesting. So so how many contract recruiters do you have that you can delegate searches to?
I have one that works with me a lot. I mean, he's probably 50% of his time or more is spent doing stuff that we do together.
Great.
And then I have two others that I work with that are kind of periodic. I might work with both of them, say 2 to 3 times a year.
Got it. Okay, fantastic. So coming back to our original premise then, in terms of this issue of being highly productive but balancing your time, I'm starting to see how you're achieving this. In one way, it's you're not trying to do everything yourself. You're recognizing, okay, if it's, you know, tasks that are below X, you know, dollar value, then I'm going to delegate, I'm going to outsource, I'm going to partner with other recruiters and so on. What else are you doing to make sure that you still have a life and you're able to spend time with your kids and your family and everything else?
Yeah. You know, I think you just have, this business can be all consuming. It never ends, and it really doesn't. And I do think you have to kind of accept, and you have to speak with your significant other about it too, that this, there is an element of this business that doesn't stop even if we're on the beach. So I think in my case, I'm very fortunate that my wife gets that. And so if we're even on vacation, for example, I'm like, look, I'm going to go down early at the hotel, and like from 8 to 10 a.m., I'm going to be doing this stuff. And then I'll hang out with you guys the rest of the day. But hey, there may be something that comes in at 3 p.m. that I have to step away and take for 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a piece of embracing what our life is and saying, look, I've chosen to sign up for something that gives me incredible freedom to be able to say, you know what, if we want to spend 25 weeks a year somewhere, theoretically, at a VRBO somewhere, we can do that. There's no reason why we can't do that. Yeah. But you just have to understand that there's a mindset around how do I continue, not how do I not drop the ball while that's happening.
Right. I hear you.
It's a very delicate balance that we have in this business.
Yes, it is. It can be hard to switch off because you don't get to the end of the day and go, okay, I'm finished for the day, right? There's always more you could do. And so being able to, you know, just switch that off to then be present for your family. And then, you know, when you might sort of be on call, as you say, that's tricky for sure. I was hoping you had some awesome solution to this, John, but sounds like you're in the same boat as me. Maybe that is par for the course. Tell me, when you were getting established in Austin in this field, what do you think were the things you did that gave you the most traction?
Yeah, I think the first thing was, calling all of my existing clients. I was fortunate enough to be able to work out a nice, easy transition with my old company. And I do think if you're leaving to start your own firm, that's critical. I mean, you really have to make sure you protect your kind of in-industry connections as well. So that was good. We were able to call most of our clients right away. And so I think it was letting them know that, hey, I'm going through a little bit of a transition. It's, you know, it's just me now, but I was able to just keep the ball rolling pretty close to the same way that I was by just getting proactive right away with, you know, hey, I'm going to have to add some new clients. I'm going to have to get a little more broad in what I do. And, just putting my head, I mean, I think the thing, if I did one thing correctly when I started my own firm, it was I had a mindset of And it turned out not to be this way. But I had a mindset that in this first year, I'm going to have to assume I have to work 80 to 90 hours a week, if necessary, to just make absolutely certain that I've got cash flow. And I could, because I was super concerned that they, you know, hey, maybe it's not me that they're following. You know, there was that little voice in my head, like,
yeah,
you know, was it maybe the firm I was working with that they were into and it wasn't me?
Yeah.
But I was so pleased to see that it actually was me. And so I was fortunate in that most of that stuff started to come over pretty quickly. So, you know, I don't have, there wasn't like a crazy, wow, there was a huge, other than 2009, you know, doing what it did to us, but it was, it came over actually pretty well together. But I do think if there was one thing, it was, I did work a lot harder the first 6 months to ensure that that pipeline was really built.
Makes sense. Makes sense. So looking back at your career to date, what advice would you have for others who are maybe, you know, they're good at what they do, but they're working too hard for the return that they're getting? Because I talk to a lot of recruiters who are in that position. They're good. They really care about their clients, and they want to, you know, they want to serve their clients, and they're just really in that hustle and grind mode, which can be the path to burnout. And they're doing okay, but they're not hitting their full potential. What would you say would be your top two or three suggestions to someone in that position?
The first thing for sure is taking inventory of how you're spending your time, really spending some time thinking about from the time you wake up. I mean, literally from the time you wake up until you go to bed, breaking it down in a very minute way. How are you spending your time? Once you get to the office, what are the tasks you're working on? What are the searches you're taking that you're personally working on? Why are you doing that? Why? So, for example, in my case, my average fee size is about 42,000, roughly.
Okay.
So that has not always been the case. There was a point where it was 20,000, and there was no reason, looking back on it, why it had to be. It was, I chose for it to be. Mm-hmm. I just said, I'll take those searches. And so I think there's some conscious decisions that you have to make about, I'm just not going to take those searches. Or if I am going to take those searches, I'm going to get help in doing those.
Right.
So I think that's the first thing, is because what that does is it starts to buy you some margin. You know, you now don't, you can literally make half the placements and make the same salary.
Exactly. So, yeah.
I don't know. Of course, at the time, I was one of those people that was caught in that race.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we get so busy doing that, we don't stop to be smart about our business and go, you know what? Why am I doing that? What is stopping me from doing these things? And so that, for me personally, that was a big one, was deciding that I needed to move upstream in the types of things that I was working on.
Yeah.
The other thing I think is, really take inventory of, especially if you're solo. What I found with me and all my friends who are going to listen to this will be laughing as I say this, because they know I still struggle with this. You can drift a lot. I mean, you can find yourself making these calls at times is extremely hard as it is. But if you're having a rough run and you just got off a really rough call, the idea of watching a documentary on YouTube that's 2.5 hours long seems pretty appealing. And I think you need to take an honest look, and there's some programs out there that'll actually give you inventory of what your digital time was, of what, you know, what you were doing at various times. And I think you'd be shocked sometimes when you look at that of, wow, what video was I watching? What was I, that was 3.5 hours that I spent on that. And I'm just being very raw and honest here, that there are times that is something that people struggle with, and you need to tighten up your time and look at it like, yeah, I worked with a coach one time who said, John, your personality type is such that you're better off having blasts of energy throughout the day because you get, I get very, I get distracted easily. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I can put a
I'm glad to hear you say that, by the way, because that gives hope to those of us who are also get distracted easily, that we can still manage, you know, in spite of those drawbacks or limitations, we can still get quite a lot of horsepower out of ourselves. Right. So how do you manage those distractions?
If I have a window, and I have a lot of throughout the year, believe me, where I have a window of time where I just feel that I'm starting to get distracted. It could be a week, it could be a month, it could be a quarter, you know, that just for whatever reason, I have life circumstances that are going on that just have me distracted. Mm-hmm. So what I'll try to do is think about my days in terms of blasts of time. So let's say I'm going to get into the office at 9 o'clock. I'll block out in my calendar, okay, we're not asking for a miracle here. 9 to 10:30, there's this task. And you're just going to go full bore on that task for 90 minutes. And then you build in a 30-minute break. You know, you build in, hey, go down. Yeah, this is, it's cool to go down to, you know, grab a soft drink or whatever and walk around the building if you have, whatever you have to do to sort of get that nervous energy out of your system. And then we're going to have another 90-minute blast. I found that you're better off having 3 90-minute blasts throughout the day than you are going in at 8 a.m. and just sort of wandering around in your brain all day. And you'll find, at least I have, when you look back on the day, you worked like 90 minutes total for the whole day,
right,
of focused, right, work. And you, but yet in your mind, you're going, you know, I don't know how I could work any harder. Well, you may not be. You may not actually be working as much as you think you are on things that are productive. At least that's been my experience.
Yeah, no, well said, for sure. I think, I mean, you've highlighted some of the fundamentals. So one is keeping a time log of what am I actually spending my time on, whether that's just with a pen and paper, or whether it's a tool that tracks like what you're actually doing. And then number two is structuring your time so that you have those blocks of focused time, for sure. Because I do think it's better to work with intensity for shorter periods of time than just say, oh, I'm going to do whatever for all morning or all day. Because realistically, you're not going to be able to stay to concentrate for that length of time and be on it. You're going to drift and you're going to pace yourself subconsciously, right? So that's a really good suggestion. And number three is taking a step back and looking at your business and thinking, well, why am I working on these types of searches? Why don't I move up the value chain and get paid more for the same effort? Right. And that could be a big shift as well.
Yeah. And Mark, also, I found as I moved up that value chain, as you said, it started to, there's less competition at the higher levels. And, you know, so that's another reason why, for example, I do a lot more what commonly here are called NPCs or most placeable candidates. If the more niche you are, the more this works.
Yes.
If you take people that you know make sense for your clients, mm-hmm, or groups of people that you know make sense for your clients, and present those people, of course, with their permission, and you've set this all up, there's no competition for that. And if you do land those things, it's obviously much larger fees. And again, it's this circle of also I'm building a different brand. You know, now my client sees me, even if they don't make the hires.
Yes.
You know, they see you as different now, you know?
Right, exactly. That's interesting. Now, you said something which is marketing a group of people. Can you speak on that? Because I'm familiar with NPC marketing. For those who don't know the acronym, it stands for most placeable candidate, which simply means you've got an A player, a really superstar individual. They're going to land somewhere because they're so good. Companies are going to, you know, are going to want to hire them. You may as well be the one who introduces them to their next employer and gets the fee, because someone's going to get a fee out of it, or what have you. But you're talking about a group. Are you talking about moving, like lifting out a whole team, or what are you talking about? Yes. There?
So it could either be a team within a company that is, for example, one time I had a client that said, we really want to open an Atlanta office for valuation services, which is something I recruit for. So I knew of a group that was within another company in my space that was active. They were starting to think about moving, but they really enjoyed working together. So it was two people initially, and they had a couple of other people that I think eventually followed them. But those two people, I thought, you know what? It's better for the client if they get them both, because they're used to working well together. That's another aha thing to me was, wait a minute, the client, they want to hire multiple people. You know, it was that kind of, is it okay for me to do that? Yes,
right,
they want
right.
to do that, you know? So that was an example of a little small kind of what I call a lift out, where you took a smaller group. But also you can do that with boutique companies, where if you have a company that's got a little niche, maybe they have 7 to 10 people, maybe 20 people, and you have a client that has $600 million in revenue, and they're looking to grow in that area, but they don't have, they're more than willing to take a look at that thing as a company. Now, if you get into some nuances where you do have to be careful with this, that if there's nuances where there's going to be capital raised or something like that, you then need to partner with somebody who has those qualifications and those designations,
right.
or you
right.
can get into some trouble for that. But it's easy to do that. You know, I mean, it's not hard to do that at all.
Interesting. I know a lady who once did move a whole team, and now she was complaining about it. She got a $1 million fee for that, but she was saying that was way less. Like, if she had had the placement fee multiplied by however many, I think it was 20 people or whatever, it would have been a lot more than that. But the client sort of wanted to cap it at $1 million, which, I mean, for most people, that would be a good payday, right? But do you find that clients are willing to pay you multiple fees for like multiple team members, or are they always going to want some kind of concession?
Yeah, that's a great point, because there is a point where you're sort of choking the deal. You know, you're making it not feasible for them to do it. If you have a group, say for example, that does $10 million in revenue, and there are five partners that are making $300,000 each, mm-hmm. and you ask for 30% of five partners at $300,000 base salaries,
right?
The deal starts to at some point not make sense for them. As a collective whole, it starts to not make sense. So if you are going to do some of this work, you do need to get kind of educated on what does buy side and sell side, what do those fees tend to look like? Mm-hmm. So even though you're not really that, like that's not your full-time kind of day job, you do need to be familiar with the terminology of how those people get paid. Because that's what, when you bring these kinds of ideas to your clients, especially if they're larger, they want to look at them in terms of how they would typically do it with an investment bank. And it's right. still a very large, I mean, it's fantastic fees. Yes. But it is, I do remember, it's funny you bring that example up, because I remember the first one I did that was of any real substance was, you know, 20 plus people. And in my mind, I'm going, wow, you know, I'm just adding the fees. And I'm going, this is going to be like, I can retire, you know, at some point right. if I do five or six of these a year. But you do have to realize that it's a different game when you do it that way. Mm. But again, if you remove yourself from, I know I sound like a broken record, but if you remove yourself from what is my fee and start thinking about how does this help the client, and just sort of embrace that, look, it's going to be a big fee. You're going to get a lot of money if you do this. Just do what's right by the client, and then you're going to get an opportunity to do more of these in the future.
Absolutely. That's a great philosophy for sure, especially for a sustainable career over the long term that generates not only placement fees but referrals and reputation. So, John, listen, we're out of time for today. I've really enjoyed meeting you. So, thank you so much for getting up super early to record this with me, in spite of the time difference. I really appreciate you and your willingness to share and help other recruiters.
Absolutely, Mark. Thanks for having me, and thanks for what you do for our industry.
Oh, well, thank you. Have an awesome day. Talk to you again.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. If you've enjoyed the show, the best way you can show your support is to click that subscribe button. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.